Okay, this is Rachel Seidman, and I'm here with Tricia Harms in Minneapolis. Today is Thursday, April 21st, 2016, and we are undertaking an oral history interview for a project that is currently called Hashtag Feminism, Speaking Up and Talking Back in the Digital Age. Tricia, I'm just going to ask you to start by telling me what you knew about your grandparents. Did you know them? Where did they come from? What do they do?
Sure. I was born to a single mom, so I only know my biological maternal grandparents. And she was 18 when I was born, so we lived with them when I was a baby. They're both from rural North Dakota. My grandma was a school teacher in a one-room schoolroom, and my grandpa's sister, little sister, was one of her students, so they met at the little school room when he went to pick up his sister from school one day. I think they had just dated a couple times, and they ended up having to get married because they were naughty. So the story that I know from them is my grandpa was being scouted for minor league baseball, and he ended up having to give that up because my grandma got knocked up. Mm. So back then, you had to get married or live in shame for the rest of your life or something. So they got married. They were young. Then they moved to the cities here in Minneapolis after a while and had four daughters. They were both German, like all German. So my grandma's parents were second generation immigrants. So their parents had come from Germany, and my grandpa's parents had come from Germany but via Switzerland. So his parents were first generation immigrants, and they were both farm kids from out in the sticks, Midwestern farm kids. So yeah, that's what I knew about them.
So your mom grew up on the farm?
My mom grew up sort of, I mean, I think they lived in a town when they were, it was like Wahpeton, North Dakota, so it's a town. But my grandpa's parents, my great-grandparents, still had their farm, so they spent a lot of time out working on that farm.
Okay. Yeah. And so your mom, tell me about your mom.
She's an incredible woman. She had me when she was 18. We lived with my grandparents for a little while, and then she just sort of struck out on her own. Went to like tech school for a while and ended up building a pretty decent career for herself. I was always really impressed that she was able to take care of me and like be a professional and command respect.
What was her job?
So she started out just doing like administrative work. When I was a baby, she was cleaning hotel rooms and working at Kentucky Fried Chicken. And we lived in a little apartment upstairs from a Chinese food, like hole-in-the-wall restaurant. And, you know, like every day all she could afford to eat was an egg roll from the restaurant downstairs. Like they had it ready for her. I don't really know, like, what she did when I was, like, between when she was a maid cleaning motel rooms to, like, when we moved to Minneapolis and she had a good job, like, working at a law firm doing accounting. She didn't go to school for it. She just, like, figured it out. Also in that time period, like, she... it's kind of a crazy story, like, the way that she met and ended up marrying the man who is now my dad, who adopted me when I was 7 or 8. They actually met in a bar when she was pregnant with me, and he was dating her best friend. And she told her best friend, you have to break up with that guy because he's a raging alcoholic and he's up to no good and He's just a, you know, sexy bad boy, but he's not boyfriend material. So the best friend did break up with him, and he basically started stalking her. He basically started stalking my mom. And by that time, she had a baby, an infant child. She's a teenager. And she ended up moving to Minneapolis to get away from him. He would do things like pass out in his car, with his car blocking her car in so she couldn't, like, leave the parking lot when she would get out of school. Or call the landline. Like, this is 1983, so we only have a landline, right? So he would call her on the phone and, like, drunkenly pass out on the phone. And so her phone was off the hook, right? So, or he would camp out outside of her apartment door. Yeah, so that's pretty intense. Like, that's kind of weird. But yeah, so she moved here to Minneapolis when I was like 2, basically, from what she tells me, to get away from him, and got a decent job here. We lived in a little rental, a basement apartment underneath some elderly people that were renting out their basement, and my grandparents still lived in North Dakota where he was, so my grandpa was also a raging alcoholic, so they would go drink together, and my grandpa would tell him where she was. So he ended up going to do some time, and my mom heard about it, and since she was here and had a decent job, for some reason, she was like, I'm going to send him a card while he's in jail. And tell him, you know, when you get out, if you want help finding a job, I'll help you find a job in the cities. So, like, she never heard back. And then one day she comes to pick me up from kindergarten. And we pull up to our little rental basement apartment. And he's standing in the driveway. And she said, what are you doing here? I had no idea who he was, obviously. I hadn't seen him since I was 2. And he just said, well, I'm sober now. It's time for us to get married. And she had a boyfriend at the time. Like, she was kind of like, well, I am, like, dating a guy and whatever. But he ended up moving in, like, shortly afterwards. And they were in love. So, I mean, it's a totally, like... Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
It's a totally fucked up story, but also, like, they really love each other.
And he, had he straightened out?
Mm-hmm. He never drank again. I mean, he still hasn't. He's going on 60 and hasn't had a drop. So, I don't know if I would call him sober. I would call him abstinent. But, and they have a tumultuous relationship, as people do who get together in those strange circumstances. But they have been married for, I think, 25 years. And they had a, so he moved in with us in, well, actually, he moved in with us for a while, like, because he was looking for a place, right? So then he got an apartment, and my mom bought a house, amazingly. Single mom was able to buy a house. In Northeast Minneapolis, and it was just the two of us for a while, and then he moved in, and then they had my brother when I was 7, and then we got in the car to go on a trip to Denver, where his my dad is what I call him now. His sister lives there, so we were gonna go on a trip to Denver with the baby brother and mom and dad. And we got to, we stopped in Omaha at my grandpa's house where he was living at the time. And then we got in the car to continue on to Denver. And after we were about half an hour away from grandpa's house, they told me that they were going to get married while we were in Colorado. And they had planned this whole elopement, and only, you know, the aunt that lived there knew about it. So then we had a really cool wedding.
Do you remember how you felt about that?
I was super excited. Just because, like, I had never probably experienced a wedding with people that I was very close to, you know, a big wedding. I had gone to one other wedding. I think it was my dad's brother got married. Right. And I don't actually can't remember if that was before or after they got married. Probably after. So maybe I had never even been to a wedding. But they had it. They, you know, it was in this old castle up in the mountains. And it was just so cool to me. But also I was just like dying for somebody to tell the secret to. But yeah, it was fun. And it was a happy memory, you know. I mean, I was 7. So my memory of it is pretty blurry. One of my favorite things about it is... it was this old stone castle is what they called it, and it had a stone porch, and so when they were doing their pictures, the like picture of the bride and groom out in front of the castle, I was like standing on the porch, and you know when you're a kid you're like, I can't see them so they can't see me, so I stood behind one of these stone pillars in my funny wedding Easter outfit thinking they can't, the photographer can't see me. But I'm totally in every one of the pictures. Just me, like, in my Easter outfit. 7-year-old awkward girl being like, they can't see me in the pictures. So, that was funny. So, like, every time we look at those pictures, it's just, there's Trisha thinking she's invisible.
That's funny. Yeah. So, as you grew up, what do you remember about kind of gender roles in your family? Because your mom had been a single mom mm-hmm. and working and supporting you and everything. Mm-hmm. What do you remember, or what do you think you learned from watching them in terms of gender dynamics or gender roles?
So, I mean, I think I learned a lot, like, women do everything, right? My mom... always just did everything. She cooked, she cleaned, she worked, she paid for everything. She was the disciplinarian. And she was also the comforter. So in that sense, I learned, like, there's not really a specific role that women have to take because I just grew up with a woman who didn't... She never put up with shit from anybody. Like, that's one really important lesson I learned very early on.
Do you have an example of...
Well, I mean, she had tons of boyfriends when I was growing up. So I remember one time she had kind of a bad boyfriend who was over at our apartment. And my memory is a little blurry, but I have a memory of him wanting to, like, whoop me with his belt. And she locked me in the bathroom and got him out of our apartment. She just was like, you know, taking care of business. There's no way you're touching my daughter. I think it was Halloween because I had a bunny costume on. Like, I remember being in the bathroom, locked in the bathroom by myself, terrified, and seeing myself in this, like, bunny costume in the mirror, which is a super bizarre memory to have. And just listening to them arguing outside, but outside of the door. And then he left. But also, you know, like, she always worked for attorneys. Who can be difficult to work with. And she was always a manager. When she sort of got to the cities and started on this career path. And she never let people walk all over her, you know. And that's something that, I mean, I still struggle with. And I think as women, it's ingrained in us to let ourselves be doormats and be small. But she never was small. Mm. So... yeah, she was an inspirational person to grow up around. When my dad moved into the house, he definitely took on more traditional male roles. So, you know, he did the lawn things and he had a manly job and he didn't clean. He took out the garbage. He became more of the disciplinarian. But... you know, I never was directly told by either of them or, like, I never felt, like, pushed into a specific gender expression or gender role.
Mm-hmm. So by the time you get to high school, how would you describe yourself? Who were you in high school?
Oh, my gosh. This is so weird to even think about. I was the most awkward high school person. I didn't know my identity. Like, I think a lot of people don't know their identity. And I think in high school, you know, some people are really good at adopting an identity and expressing it, right? And I just was, like, a weirdo. I had my hands in all of these different pots. Like, I want to be an artist. I want to be a musician. I want to be super goth. I want to be punk rock. I want to be a feminist. I want to wear overalls. I want to wear fancy dresses all the time. Like, I just did not know what to do with myself. It didn't help. Like, I was a fat kid, right? Like, it's really hard to be a fat kid, and I think it's even harder if you're a girl. And I was also struggling with my sexuality, so I was just kind of, like, the most awkward creature you could encounter in the world. I feel like if I met myself now as that person, I would just be, like, really uncomfortable, but also really, like, I feel so bad for you. So, and, like, not that that experience is unique. Like, every high schooler is a weirdo, and everybody looks back at their high school days and just cringes, I'm sure, except for, like, the coolest people who are not cool anymore. Yeah, so I was just, like, a super awkward weirdo. I was the president of the German club. I played, like, every instrument in band. I had a couple friends. I was also, like, I really wanted to be a badass, but I was such a goody-two-shoes my whole life. Like, I was always very concerned with making my parents proud of me and not disappoint. I still hate the feeling of disappointing them or disappointing people that care about me, you know? Which is interesting. Like, my brother, he lives here. He's in the basement right now. He's 7 years younger than me, and he never gave a shit. You know, he just did whatever the fuck he wanted to all the time. And I would be like, if I drive 1 mile past where my dad told me I had to stop the car, he's gonna know. So it was just weird. I had a lot of conflicting identities inside of myself. So I had short hair. I had green hair. I was really uncomfortable with my body and tried to hide it. But I also adopted this sort of, like, I don't give a shit if I'm fat persona, which I held on to for a really long time. So high school was rough. Mm. It was rough. Mm.
You said one of the things you were toying with was, I want to be a feminist. Mm-hmm. What did that mean to you at the time?
So, the first thing I really associated with feminism was being pro-choice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't know a lot of history of the women's movement or what it really meant to be a feminist. I just knew, like, I had a conversation with my mom where we were both just like, well, it's fucked up if people are saying women can't have abortions. And I was like, absolutely. That's something I, like, want to do something about. And then, like, when I was in high school, it was also, like, the blooming of the internet. So I found a couple message boards. The one that I was most active on was the Bust Magazine message board. And, like, the women that I encountered on there were just, like, so inspiring in how confident and true to themselves they were and how outspoken they were on issues that mattered to them and how they were able to, like, take this feminist mentality and apply it to their own lives and just live their lives in sort of a feminist, pro-woman, I want to do what I want to do and fuck everybody else kind of way. So to me, in high school, that's what it was, you know? Just, like, I just want to be a bad bitch who crusades for women.
Do you remember how you found those message boards? Or was there someone who sort of pointed you toward them, or...?
So I had this one friend who was always a little bit cooler than me. So she, her name is Emily. I'm pretty sure she found Bust for me, or somebody gave me a Bust magazine. or some, I can't remember exactly. Maybe we found a bust magazine at a bookstore. But then we found the website. And we were both super active on the message boards. And then we ended up having like a bust meetup. And I'm still friends with one of the girls that we had a meetup with. Emily and I are both still friends with her.
So tell me, what does it mean to be active on a message board? And then what is a meetup? But start with a message board. What were you doing?
Just like posting, you know. I mean, I guess they still have message boards, but it's just like a thread of conversation. So, you know, there would be like, what's the crafty shit you did today? Or like, what do you think about the thing that this person said in this magazine? Let's talk about this. Mm-hmm. Or let's do one of the things we did was like a girl song, girl singer mixtape exchange. So, yeah, I mean, it was just whatever, but it was just a bunch of awesome ladies.
Mm-hmm. And then the meetup, what was that?
It was just like we have made the May Day parade here, so... So May Day was coming, and so all of the women from the message board who lived in the Twin Cities decided to get together at this big festival and just do the festival together. So we had a big picnic, and I think there were like 12 people, and made friends. Mm-hmm. It was just like the first kernel of meeting people from the internet.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's moving from this sort of virtual space into real community. And you continued to meet with those
members? Yeah, we had a couple more meetings. There were more, you know, like, we didn't have so many, like, big meetings after that. It turned into more just, like, a couple of us remained friends over a long period of time and had little get-togethers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so then, were you looking toward going to college after high school?
I was. I started doing college in high school. Like, I did the PSEO program.
What's that?
Post-secondary education option. So it's basically where your high school pays for you to go to college classes. Mm-hmm. So I took, like, German because I was super nerdy and spoke German better than anyone at the school. So they sent me to the college. They sent me to the U for German and some other classes. So I stayed at the U for one semester, and then I met a boy on the internet and decided to move to Chicago and go to college in Chicago for fashion design because that's where he lived. So I did it. I was 18, and my dad and I went out to Chicago, our first, like, trip that we ever took together, stayed in the world's shittiest, grossest motel while we looked for apartments, and he was just appalled at the whole situation.
Did you meet the boy?
No, the boy was a secret. Like, they thought I was just going to go to college, you know? And so we finally found this apartment, and he was like, good, let's get out of this hellhole city. And we came home. Then we packed up all my stuff. The whole family went out, you know, set up my apartment, and they left. And then I was in Chicago. And, I dated the boy for, like, 2 years. He ended up moving in with me. I dropped out of college pretty quickly. Mm. I think I went for a year.
Why did you drop out?
Money. I was really, like, I didn't get my financial aid in order, you know? So then it was like, well, you owe them $1 million. And, I was kind of just having a big party and didn't take care of business. So I dropped out. And then it was just, like, really hard to make it there, you know, like, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have, like, a goal because I had dropped out of school, so I wasn't, like, pursuing anything. And I'm definitely the kind of person who needs to have a path forward. So, and I wasn't really happy in that relationship anyways. It was kind of just, like, I think having, been very insecure all through high school, and then finally having this person who really adored me and really loved me was really exciting. But, you know, even if that person really loves you and really adores you, if it's not the right person for you, you have to move on at some point. So I moved back. And I moved back in with my mom for like 6 months. And then I got an apartment here in North Minneapolis. And I just started like working at a coffee shop and just really focusing on paying down all of this debt that I had racked up so I could go back to school. And trying to figure out like what the hell I wanted to do with my life. And that was just like that whole period of time between like Chicago and going back to school is kind of a blur because I just was like working super hard. I didn't really have a goal or an ambition or a passion. I just partied and worked. So it's a blur. Mm-hmm. Then when I finally went back to school, I went to MCTC when I must have been 23 or 24. I started going back to community college.
MCTC is Metro...
Minneapolis Community and Technical College. Mm-hmm. So I paid down my debt enough. You know, I paid back all my student loans enough for them to allow me to take out more student loans, basically. Mm-hmm. Which is always a great plan. And I worked, I stayed at that coffee shop, and I worked and worked and worked, and I went to MCTC, and I went through this phase where I was like, I want to be a baker, I want to own a bakery, so I'm going to go for pastry school, but I ended up doing, like, business management, because I was like, I really have always wanted to be my own boss, and I always have been the kind of person who's, like, got a million ideas about cool businesses to start. So that was what I did, and I got done at MCTC, and I still didn't really have a clear idea of what I was doing. Now I had this weird associate's degree that I didn't really know what to do with. So I was like, well, maybe I'll go, like, to school for real shit. Like, one of my English teachers at MCTC had just been like, you have a lot more in you than just being, you know, a manager somewhere or working at a coffee shop. So, I think her exact words, I remember this very clearly, were, you are a scholar, you belong at a real college. So, I just was like, I guess I'm going to go to real college. I don't know what else to do. And by that time, I was like 26. Mm-hmm. So, I ended up going to Hamline to get my bachelor's. And I did women's studies in English. So... you know, I didn't know a whole lot about women's studies, but I knew that I was passionate about women's rights. Mm. And I love history. And, you know, obviously women are underrepresented in history. So women's studies seemed like a good fit. And I also, like, have always loved literature and writing. So that made sense. I still didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I had an idea in my head that I was going to go to... I was going to go get my master's in library science. But I ended up not doing that. So.
Who did you study with at Hamline?
I studied with Kristen Maple Bloomberg. I bet you've heard mm-hmm. quite a bit, a lot of her. She was definitely one of my first real mentors. Not in like an official capacity, but somebody that I looked up to as a mentor and still do. Mm-hmm. And I stayed in touch with her. She just came to my wedding. She's great and really, you know, helps you figure out what to do with the knowledge that you've gained and, like, helps you find a path and helps you apply it. And really, like, sparked this sort of motivation to... create change in mm-hmm. the world and not just be an academic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so is he dry? I can put him upstairs. I'm sorry. Yeah, so I did that. And then I had another really great advisor in my English program. Who her name was Vina Deo.
How do you spell that?
V-E-E-N-A-D-E-O. Okay. And she had done a lot of work on the Great Migration and the African diaspora and African American literature, which is not my specialty at all, but it was at the time, that's what I ended up kind of doing my senior thesis on. And she was just a really great person for me to have as a guide at the time. And she had had like this, like a very like, not outright, like, I'm a feminist and this is what I did, but her path had been so, she had just been so determined to make it through all of these systems that have been designed to keep her down.
Mm. Was she African American?
No, she was Indian, like, from India.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she had, like, gone and gotten her doctorate in Kentucky, which I can't imagine was easy at the time when she was there doing her doctorate in African American literature as an you know, an immigrant woman from India.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she was amazing. And they both encouraged me to go on to graduate school. So I did. Still not knowing what the hell I'm going to do with my life. It basically came down to, like, do I go to the Humphrey Institute at the U of M, which is a public policy, it's a really intense public policy program. And it's very, the way I usually describe it is it's very quantitative and economic focused. And then this other program popped up, like, out of nowhere. I was kind of like, what the hell am I going to do? I got to go to grad school before they have to start paying back those other loans. And Erin Parrish from the Women's Consortium sent me a message, an email or a Facebook message or something, saying, I just heard about this really cool program that is up in Duluth. You should look at it. And it was the Master of Advocacy and Political Leadership program.
Now, how did you two know each other?
I had interned at the Women's Consortium when I was doing my Women's Studies bachelor's. Yeah, so like 2 weeks before the semester started, I called the MAPL people. And I was like, I really want to do this program. It looks amazing. And I went and like had my entry interview at the founder's house. The founder of the program was just like, come over, let's talk, we'll see if it's a good fit. And then 2 weeks later, I was in grad school. So I wasn't even in grad school. I was like in a van of random people from grad school driving up to Duluth together to start grad school. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Did you then live in Duluth for a while?
Nope, we would go every weekend. Mm. We would get a van. At the time, it was through the U of M. It was at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. So we would get a U of M van from the cities and drive it up together and then drive it back. So we were only there for one night. Now the program has moved to Metro State University, which is in St. Paul. And people commute together from greater Minnesota to come to the program. So
it was aimed at people who were working?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, and at that point, I was still at the coffee shop. I had worked at the coffee shop at that point for more than 10 years.
Mm. Which coffee shop?
It's called The Coffee Shop Northeast. I recommended that you go there. If you go there, they have pictures of me in the bathroom making funny faces at the toilet. So when you sit down to pee, there's Trisha just like making faces at you. Yeah, so it started out as Audubon Coffee when I was 20. I started working there. And then that owner closed, and then the two women that I worked with there, who were sisters, and I decided to reopen it as a new shop. Mm-hmm. So I was going to be their business partner. And that was right around the time when I was looking at grad school. Or when I was deciding what to do about moving on from MCTC. So I was like, should I open this coffee shop with these people or should I go to college? And I ended up bailing on them and going to college. And then I was a manager there for, you know, another 8 years when it reopened as the Coffee Shop Northeast. Mm.
And so what was it about the program in Duluth that sounded so great to you?
It's really person-centered. And I know that that's a term that gets thrown around a lot and means a lot of different things, but it's really customizable. The idea of having a cohort that you spend time with, it's basically structured like you have a cohort that you do one class with each semester, the same group of people. And then you also spend every weekend with that same group of people. And then there's electives that you don't necessarily have. You have with other folks who aren't in your cohort. But on a personal level, I had never had like a dorm or a traditional college experience or living with other people or like being in the kind of setting where you create lasting friendships outside of high school. So that part of it was really appealing to me. Like, I'm going to be, like, when I went to Hamline, I was 10 years older than everybody else that was there. So I didn't make friends. And of course, like, I was 28, so I had my life going on. But that part of that, the part about, like, just having that core group of people and having that sort of experience was really appealing to me. But the program is really focused on how to create change in the areas that you want to work in. So you can focus on nonprofit work. You can focus on like public running for public office, or how to be what you do when you are in office. You know, how does the legislature work? How to run campaigns? You can concentrate on the labor, organized labor sector, or I think now they also just opened a business focused concentration, but when I was there it was nonprofit, public sector, or labor. So I ended up doing the nonprofit concentration just because it made the most sense to me, because I at that time I felt like I was going to be going into advocacy work. So yeah, I learned how to, you know, start a nonprofit, run a nonprofit, do taxes for a nonprofit, run a board, be effective, you know. Mm-hmm. But another big thing that really is appealing about that program is the network that you come out of it with. So a lot of the instructors are really well-known names in their fields, and we host events that are aimed at making sure that students who are in this program come out of it with a network that cares about them, mm-hmm. so that they can succeed in not just like having a career, but like doing good work for Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So
as you were doing all of this, were women's issues at the center of what you were thinking you wanted to work on?
Yeah, definitely. I had interned at the Women's Consortium. Mm-hmm. I did another internship at the Women's Consortium during my graduate studies, and I maintained my involvement with them. And I also, you know, like most of my big projects in grad school were focused on a lot of reproductive health, reproductive, you know, health care access. And when I got my job at the union, like, halfway through the program.
The union asked me where
I work, yeah. So then I was working on issues that are economic issues, and I was also still volunteering at the Women's Consortium, and I was working on my degree. And it started to really come together how all of those things sort of meshed together to form, like, this is where I fit into this, where my passion is, and the work that I've been given to do, and the work that I'm capable of doing. So my, right now, my focus is really, like, reproductive justice and women's economic security, right? And, like, what I'm focused in on really right now is economic security for women of color. And I mean, I think as the women's movement in general, we have been, unfortunately, like, a white woman's movement for a very long time. And I think that that is, I mean, that's really terrible in a lot of ways, but also, like, we can't continue to call this a women's movement or a feminist movement if we're not being inclusive. So right now, particularly at the Women's Consortium, I'm doing a lot of work on equity and inclusivity and making sure that the policy work we do doesn't impact groups that are silenced differently than it impacts, like, the white ladies that are at the table talking about these issues.
So how did you start thinking in that way? Who'd you learn that from?
Well, so my job is communications at the union. I work in communications, specifically digital communication. Excuse me. So part of that is, like, when I am speaking for 43,000 people, I am faced with coming up with a way to frame whatever we're asking our members to get behind, in a way that makes them feel passionate about it. So in some ways, like, it's really easy for me to talk about economic issues if I say, like, look, these women are struggling because we can't raise the minimum wage, right? Like, but then, so part of it is, like, I'm in this industry where I'm having to use those as messages, but then it started to, like, really connect to me. Like, I'm not really sure where it made the connection, but I think part of it was I did a project on food security, and it was, you know, how does this specifically impact women? Why is food security a women's issue? Why is racial justice a women's issue? Why is the minimum wage important to women? You know, so it came more to me to be like, every social justice issue impacts women in a myriad of different ways, right? And those consequences are overshadowed all of the time.
Tell me more about the union. Who are these members? What's the focus of the work that the union does?
So I work for a union of 43,000 public employees.
Okay. What does this stand for?
It is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I do digital communications for them. And so when I speak for the union, I'm speaking for all of our members, based on directives that the board of directors that have been elected by our members have given to my supervisor and then down to me.
What percentage of your members are people of color?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things that I've been hearing a lot about from different perspectives is the Women's Economic Security Act
mm-hmm.
that was passed. Mm-hmm. And I'm really interested in that and the Women's Consortium, because the Women's Consortium is unique
mm-hmm.
in the country and seems to me, you know, the women WISA is also pretty unique
mm-hmm.
in the country, and I think there's a
connection there. Go ahead.
I think that part of that is because Minnesota is unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know how to articulate that, but, you know, we're the home of Paul Wellstone. We have a lot of people who still cling to that era and those values. I think a lot of people think of his slogan as the Minnesota slogan. That was, we all do better when we all do better. And we've always been a progressive state, even when we haven't necessarily elected progressives. In general, we've always been a pretty progressive state. Huge voter turnout, and huge involvement, huge civic involvement. So, yeah, it is unique. The consortium and that package of bills are completely unique. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that they weren't. You know, I wish that they were everywhere. But this year we have another Women's Economic Security Act. It's the Women of Color Opportunities Act.
Mm.
And I'm really excited about that. I think it has not gotten as much traction as I was hoping for. And unfortunately, I've been distracted, like, with the things I'm working on at work. So I haven't been able to focus on it completely.
So where is that coming from?
Who's doing that?
Yeah.
There's two state representatives, Rena Moran. She's from St. Paul. RENAMORAN.
Mm-hmm.
And Representative or Senator Patricia Torres Ray. TORRESRAY. Yep, so they are behind the bill, or it's a package of bills that invest in economic opportunities specifically geared for women of color. And my understanding is a lot of them are also geared towards neighborhoods where there's a lack of economic opportunities, North Minneapolis, where we are right now, being one of them. I don't know if you noticed, but there's not a whole lot of job opportunities around here. There's also not a whole lot of access to resources or, you know, basic needs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a food desert,
mm-hmm.
By technical terms. It won't be for very much. Well, this one still will be here. If we went down a couple blocks, they're building a new co-op down there. But, yeah, there's no grocery store within walkable distance here. There's convenience stores with junk food. That's it. There's also nowhere to have a job over here. So if you don't have a job, you can't afford a car. If you don't have a car, you can't drive to a job. If you don't have a grocery store you can walk to, you end up feeding your family junk food from the convenience store, which happens to also be like 4 times more expensive. Even if, like, if you buy real food at the convenience store, it costs 4 times as much. So it's like, I mean, how do we expect anybody to climb that ladder,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So the new bills, do you think they're, well, I was talking earlier today with Kenya McKnight,
mm-hmm.
and so part of what she was saying was the first set of bills, the LISA, didn't help Black women very much. Is that your impression too? Do you think that is, that opinion is shared by other people?
Not being a Black woman, I really like don't have the authority to make that judgment. But I feel that the laws that were passed were not as comprehensive as we had hoped.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the way the system works is when you have a package of very progressive bills, pieces get chopped off at every step, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we finally got to the end, it was missing a lot of stuff that we had really hoped to get in there.
Like what?
Paid family leave. which we're working on this, you know. But things like, you know, requiring employers to allow nursing mothers appropriate accommodations. I don't think that that doesn't not help Black women. But I agree with Kenya that there need to be specific legislative initiatives that target improving economic circumstances for Black women. I think that that package of bills was not as successful at helping women for all women because it got chopped down so much, right? And I think when we have bills, and I don't honestly remember all of the specifics of WESA, like I don't remember everything it accomplished. But, you know, like if you pass paid family leave only for state employees, of course that disproportionately benefits the majority people of who are white that work there, right? So like, yes, in some ways Kenya's totally right. Just because the people that those are impact, the groups of people that are covered by those requirements or regulations are in specific types of jobs, which other marginalized groups of people have not had adequate opportunities to get into. So, yeah. No, I agree with her somewhat. I don't have specifics about it.
So, okay, so you found your kind of niche by combining the women's economic issues and the union work.
What I love about working for unions, about working for this union, but about the labor movement, is that women who are in unions always do better. And women in communities where there's strong union membership, even if they're not in a union, also do better. And I also really love that unions are willing to stand up for economic legislation that helps people who aren't their members. So my biggest example on this is raising the minimum wage, right? Like state employees don't make minimum wage. County employees don't make minimum wage. None of our members make minimum wage. We spent a whole year putting all of our force behind getting Minnesota's minimum wage lifted by $2. Because we care about helping everyone out. You know, it just like I feel really strongly that like unions are one of the last major forces, like holding the line for letting people even get into the middle class, or helping people climb out of that hole just a little bit. I feel like the middle class, it doesn't even exist anymore. I mean, on paper, sure, I'm middle class, but I still fucking live paycheck to paycheck, you know? But like, the opportunity for anyone to move up in the world is so small. And I think for women specifically, having a union there to back you up is one of the best, I don't want to call it a backup plan, but it's a good support system, you know? It protects women from not getting paid as much, from being passed over for a promotion, from not being taken seriously, and it gives them a place to have their voice heard about issues that impact them. So I think the women's movement and the labor movement would do well to work together more closely.
Well, I was going to ask you, you see these kind of connections, but do you feel like the union, are you like the only feminist in the union, or is that a kind of welcomed perspective, and are women's issues seen as the bread and butter of the union?
So this falls in two different ways. I represent the union in my role on the Women's Consortium Board. So AFSCME Council 5 supports the work financially and by giving my time to them that the consortium does. And we also always stand up for issues of choice. You know, when Planned Parenthood is under attack, we speak up for them. We're there for them. Unfortunately, like, organized labor is being attacked from every aspect just as much as reproductive health, right? So we just barely survived the Supreme Court case where, I don't wish to speak ill of the dead, but if Antonin Scalia had not passed away when he did, the labor movement would have been crushed. There's 5 more Supreme Court cases just like that, like in the pipeline. So just like there's 17 Supreme Court cases trying to defund Planned Parenthood or take away access to any sort of reproductive health care for women, or ban transgender people from using the bathroom they want to use. Whatever it is, there's so many things, but we're so preoccupied with just like not letting Alec destroy organized labor and turn America into a right to work country that we don't have the capacity to focus on issues that our members really do care about. That's the strategy, right? Like, if we're always on offense or always on defense, we can't help our allies. So it's like, you know, fucking divide and conquer. It works.
Mm-hmm. When we were talking about your, so I want to stick with your, you're the communications person. And mostly digital.
Yeah, so I work for our public affairs director is my mm-hmm. supervisor. She's like our communications director.
Okay.
And then there's me. I do digital.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is mostly external communications, okay. So.
So I'm interested because you were saying you were there when the message board started. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm interested in the how you see your work in the union, but also the feminist movement stuff, being affected by the rapid sort of shifts in social media, and how, what you think about all of that.
I mean, I love the internet. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think it's also a place where it's really dangerous to be a woman. Like, it's emotionally dangerous to be a woman on the internet. But it's also an amazing platform, and it allows us to share messages that wouldn't get heard. I don't know, like, there's definitely this culture of, like, people like me have this, you know, maybe 20 years ago, if I had been me now, I wouldn't be... I think there's a certain kind of person who likes a lot of attention, and the internet has created this little pile of people who, like, their goal is to achieve internet virality, right? And unfortunately, I think that that's taken over a lot of our interpersonal lives. So it's, you know, I think there's a fine line about the good that it does. And, you know, thank God we can run campaigns online, and I love to be able to tweet to the media, and I love having so much more access to so many more people. But there's so many terrible things that happen on the internet, and it can crush people. So I don't know.
I read somewhere a blog piece you wrote after you had surgery. That was the only one I saw. Had you been blogging before that? Did you have a sort of regular?
So I always want to blog. I always have. I've wanted to be a blogger. I've started blogs. I never follow up with them. So I had my weight loss surgery, and it was a hard decision because I had been identifying as a body positive, self-loving, happy, fat person, feminist. But I came to this decision that I just had to do it for myself. And I read another article on that website, and it was shaming women who had had weight loss surgery. And that piece that I wrote was just a direct reactionary, you know, just because I made a decision that you don't approve of doesn't mean I'm not a feminist or that I'm a bad feminist. And, you know, I think my way of looking at what feminism is has always been, it means you do what is good for you because you make your own decisions. And if that means you are a girly girl who fits all of the gender roles that have been assigned to you and you like it that way, that's awesome. If you don't fit into any of those roles, that's awesome too. If you're fat and happy and you love your body, that is super awesome. And if you're skinny and happy and you love your body, that is super awesome too. And if you want to show your body to the world, whatever body that is awesome too. Whatever you want to do with yourself, like, fucking do it. That's what feminism is to me. And share that message. You know, like, fight for other women. Stand up for other women. Don't fucking hate other women. And don't let gender or beauty standards or external pressure of whatever stop you from doing what is good and the best choice for you, no matter what kind of choice that is. So, you know, when I am on a website that is supposed to be feminist and there's somebody shaming other women for anything, like, I think that should be the first tenet of, like, are you a feminist? Well, no, I shame women on the internet all day. Like, then I think not, you know? So I had to write it. Because I was also at this point in, I think it had been about a year since I'd had my surgery, or maybe 9 months. And I had lost a significant amount of weight, but not to where I am now. I was still fairly overweight. I don't know. And I was really struggling with finding other women who had a similar experience as me, who didn't come from hating their body and who didn't come from, I'm having this surgery so I can get skinny and all the men will love me and I can finally get married and have the life I always wanted. I came from a totally different place, and I didn't find that voice on the internet. And that was the first time I really felt like I had something to say that hadn't already been said and that needed to be said and heard. Like, people need to know that every woman doesn't lose weight so that other people enjoy looking at them. So, there it is. I just had to write it. And I respect the person who wrote the other article that I responded to. I respect her opinion. You know, she wrote about how her mom tried to force her to have weight loss surgery, but then it went on to talk about how everyone who has weight loss surgery is just giving in to all of these things, and made sweeping generalizations, and really made me feel shamed for a decision that I had made about my own body. Well, you know, I believe that any decision I make about my body is my decision, and it's none of your fucking beeswax. So there that is.
And was there a conversation that started as a result of that? Like, did people respond?
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like you were heard?
I did. And I was really inspired and motivated by how much people responded. People who hadn't come from the same perspective as me, like who hadn't had that experience, but still were like, wow, that was really meaningful, and I appreciate this new way of looking at that. Because I think that people who don't have, who don't experience fatness, but then also don't experience weight loss or weight loss surgery, you know, it's totally foreign to them, the whole concept. So, you know, there is this unfortunate conception that people who have weight loss surgery are just like taking the easy way out of being fat, right? So I think that that helped explain that to some people. It helped open some people's eyes to that. But it also, like, there were other women who read it who were like, wow, I had weight loss surgery and I went through the same thing you're experiencing and I didn't know who to talk to about it. And it's amazing to read from somebody else who felt this way. And there were other women who messaged me, like found me on Facebook and started sending me messages saying, thank you so much for writing that. I've been struggling with this decision because I don't physically feel well, but I'm afraid that if I decide to have this surgery, my fat positive friends will disown me, you know? And I think it's just really heartbreaking to be someone who struggles with your body your whole life. As much as you can be a body positive, fat positive, body loving person, it doesn't change the way the world treats you as a fat person. And it doesn't eliminate the amount of shame that you experience and internalize. So, you know, to live your whole life like that, and finally have a community of friends who accept you as you are, and then to make a decision about your body and have them turn around and desert you over it is just the most heartbreaking thing I can imagine. And, I mean, luckily that didn't happen to me because I wasn't really involved in those communities of fat positivity. I was really on the fringe, like reading other people's blogs, but I never really participated in it. So I didn't, you know, it's not like I had like fucking Virgie Tovar over there being like, Trisha Harms, I can't believe you had weight loss surgery. No, it didn't happen to me because I'm not huge on the internet. But I still felt like I'm not going to be welcome in that community now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's this whole, like that's just like a minor part of, yeah, I mean, I don't know how many women experience like being a part of that online community and then having weight loss surgery and then feeling, you know, I don't know, spurned from it or something. But your life changes so much. Just the way people treat you changes so much. And it's really difficult to have everybody's focus is your body for years. So to have that core group of people that you felt comfortable with, that you could trust, sort of just disown you is... I don't think it's very nice. And it didn't even happen to me, but I know that it happens to people, and I felt like somebody had to write about it. If you're standing up against shaming people for being fat, you shouldn't be turning around and shaming people for making decisions to not be fat. I always said to people before, like, my health is none of your business. It's my business, right? My health is still nobody's fucking business. Mm-hmm. And those are, I just see a lot of the logic that's used that made sense to me and still makes sense to me is then used against or used, you know, not applied when somebody makes decisions that people don't agree with.
Mm-hmm. So I want to move to a different topic, which is... in addition to WISA, Minnesota, and we were talking about Minnesota being progressive and unique in some ways, it was also way out front in the gay marriage fight. Was there a... well, we didn't really talk about... We talked about earlier your sort of struggling with your identity, but I guess my biggest question is there a linkage between the... you know, women's movement, feminist community in Minnesota, and the gay marriage, were they allies? Was that a part of the fight or not? Or were those two separate kind of movements?
I'm not an expert on this because I was not active in the gay marriage campaigning. My take on it is that it was totally a white man's gay marriage movement. You know, poor queer people are not concerned about having the right to get married. They're concerned about, you know, having the right to not get fired for being gay on the job or having the right to not get beat up for being gay. Trans queer people of color specifically are worried about not getting stabbed on the street. Sure, like... this is super weird for me to say because, like, 2 years after it passed, I totally got gay married, right? Like, but, and I loved it, and it was great. But when this was happening, I wrote a blog for the Women's Consortium when I was interning there that just was like, you know what? This is not the fight that we need to be fighting. And all of you people... who have the time and resources to be fighting for permission to get married, better not turn around and walk away from this fight when you get this. Because there is so much more work to be done. And unfortunately, I don't know how much of that work is getting done. And I don't know how much that big group of gay-identified people with time and resources to put into that campaign have stuck around to help the people that still got left behind.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, do you identify with the is the wave terminology useful to you? Do you identify as a third wave feminist?
Yeah, I guess I would. I used to identify more as like a radical feminist, but...
what did that mean to you?
You know, I don't even remember because it's been so long since I studied women's studies. But I just... radical feminists now tend to... I think of them more as second wave and be very trans exclusionary. And third wave to me is more this whole like do your own thing, speak up for yourself and speak up for other women and, you know, be a slut if you want to be a slut and do what empowers you. And encourage everybody else to live that life too, you know, and stand up and speak out when people are hurting other people. So yeah, I definitely identify with that. Okay. Yeah.
Well, what do you see as the kind of biggest challenge for feminists today?
I brought this up earlier, like, feminism cannot be a white movement. Like, that means we're obsolete, right? Feminism needs to be not just speaking for other people, but creating space for women who have been silenced to be heard, finally. Mm-hmm. Like, and that is exemplified in this issue that Kenya is talking about with WISA didn't help Kenya's community like it should have. Organizations like the Women's Consortium need to be working harder to make sure that women like Kenya are at the table making the decisions, not just sitting at the table being silenced by the rest of us.
And do you feel optimistic that that will happen?
I think it's happening. I think the feminist movement has a PR problem as a PR person. And I think it's coming from a lot of directions. So there's, you know, men's rights activists. There's people like the podcaster Milo Yiannopoulos, who travels the world holding, you know, town halls about how feminism is unnecessary and the oppression of women is a myth. So I'll spell it out for you. Okay. Milo, M-I-L-O, Y, I, A, E, M, N, O, P, O, U, L, I, S. Please look him up. I recently organized a protest at the U to go protest him when he was in town. He always claims he can't find a feminist who's willing to debate him because they know he'll win every debate. But he's just a bully who insists that he wins. Mm-hmm. Similar to Donald Trump, you know.
Did you debate him?
No, I didn't. Nobody invited me. But nobody asked any feminist that I know to debate him. He ended up having a debate, but it was mostly a talk with another anti-feminist public speaker. So,
how was the rally?
It was good. It was organized in collaboration with Students for a Democratic Society. So it was on the U campus. I think there were about 75 people there. It was good. It got on the news. Yeah. So I mean, we've got people like that out there talking about how feminism is just, you know, a piece of bullshit. And then we've got another group of people who need feminism who have not been represented by feminism, mm-hmm. and who feel alienated by it. And it's also really hard to be coming from a movement that is seen as a white movement and historically white and with money, because I mean, you gotta, if you have time to do the women's movement, you have some resources available to you, generally speaking. It's really hard to come from that and not usurp anybody else's experience and not speak for people. Oh my god. Oh my god. I'm so sorry.
That was hilarious.
What? He just jumped on her back. Come on, Frank.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Oh man.
Come on.
Sorry, I thought he was doing okay.
Are your recordings usually this act full of action?
Aaron Parrish had a
puppy
who was equally wanted to be part of the story.
Yeah. So I think it's happening. At the consortium, we've really been focused on not just being inclusive, but on lifting up voices and actively working on policy issues that target underrepresented groups of women. But it's a long road, for sure. I mean, I think that if women still agree that we still need feminism, which I do, this is something we're all going to need to work very hard on together, and it's going to be difficult and painful and complicated and slow, because it's, you know, you can't undo all of that in 6 months.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you think we should talk about, or that you want to get into the record?
I don't know. I'm glad that we talked about the weight loss surgery. That's probably my biggest thing that I like to talk about. Yeah, I'm good.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.